I'm Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel. This is a podcast episode brought to you by Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study.
Our Vayikra series, Kedushas in the Details, explores the way the laws in the book try and elevate each of our most basic human functions, food intake, bodily functions, relationships, spaces of worship, and time. This year, I'll be taking a particularly honest and candid look at the way these laws do or do not yet function in our lives. Today's episode has been sponsored in memory of Diana Lubin, Dina Chana Bat Rafael Meir Uminet, on her 8th Yahrzeit, dedicated by her family. The Yahrzeit is on Kaftel Nisan. I remind you that sponsoring a podcast is a wonderful way to mark any occasion. Write me at podcast@matan.org.il or check out the donation webpage on the Matan website or contact the office directly. Parshat Acharei Mot can be divided into three parts. The first section treats what we now call the Avodah of Yom Kippur, the atonement process the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, performs, even though it is never explicitly called that by the Torah. This unit seems to be the culmination of the unit on bodily impurities, where we have a rite that can absolve all the impure ills of society. There's something incredibly moving about the idea that while individuals can go through their own purification processes and rites, that the representative member of the purified community, i.e. the Kohen Gadol, once a year is there to hold them and all that they've experienced. The second section of the Parsha treats the prohibition to slaughter outside accepted precincts of the temple, another boundary clarification in the wake of Nadav and Avihu's death, as well as the ways to deal with the blood of the animals that are sacrificed. Once it is made clear that we are not allowed to eat this blood because it represents the life force of the animal, we must learn how to dispose of it, what to do with it. Interestingly, this section relates to several other issues in the Torah. First, it sheds light, according to some, on the allowance to eat meat, seemingly putting more boundaries on what was allowed in the post-flood world. The word ta'ava, basal ta'ava, or the meat of desire, is used here, which is also interesting to think about how it frames meat eating, and also how it connects to the section that follows about sexual desires and sexual relationships. Additionally, the perspective on blood, that it preserves the life force, explains for the first time in Vayikra why we might be treating women's monthly bleeding so seriously. The third section opens with a general warning not to behave like the Canaanites. While the text here only treats prohibited sexual relationships, in the other books of Torah we will be warned not to follow the dress and pagan aspects of their lives and beliefs as well. Today, I am excited to welcome back my friend, colleague, and returning podcast guest, Shana Goldberg, who teaches Israeli and American post-high school students and serves as the Mashkicha Ruchanit in the Migdal Oz Beit Midrash for Women. She is Yoetz al Halacha, a contributing editor for Derecheha, womenandmitzvot.org, and the author of the book, What You Really Want, Trust and Fear in Decision-Making at Life's Crossroads and in Everyday Living. This is Shana's fourth or perhaps fifth time on the podcast. Shana, it is a pleasure to have you here.
So great to be back here with you, Yosefa.
So the reason why I really wanted to have you back here, Shana, for this episode is because I wanted to sort of do a follow-up to the episode we did last year on what was then a connected parsha of Tezriah Metzora. And we tried to sort of flesh out what a sort of a sexual ethic or sexual ideas that were being brought to our attention or trying to be, I don't know, taught to us through the different halachot that sort of govern our sexual relationships, both the prohibited and the permissible relationships. And today we're sort of coming back here again to speak about what I think we maybe can call sort of the central fence, which is a nice translation of the Hebrew, the gader, around the both the laws of nida and prohibited or currently prohibited sexual relationships. So let me just say that really clearly, that today we want to speak about, when it comes to single men and women, the topic of Shmirat Negiah, okay, which we'll speak about how that relates to all this and where that comes from. And we also want to speak about the Harchakot, which are sort of also this fence around the Halachot of Nidah. So we are going to sort of divide our conversation into two parts today. First, speaking about Shmirat Negiah, which again relates to this list of these, I think, prohibited sexual relationships, and then afterwards focusing on married couples, and both a little bit halachically, but also really sort of from a broader philosophical, maybe hashkafic perspective on them. So Shana, to start off our conversation today, I what's interesting is that I sort of divided this conversation into two parts, but in reality, these two parts actually emerge from the same text, okay? So why don't you bring us into that text and sort of the way the halacha develops?
Absolutely. So this all comes back to chapter 18, Perek Vayikra in Vayikra, Parshat Achmarim, which discusses the long list of arayot, the list of illicit sexual relationships that include incest, adultery, and also anida, a woman who has menstruated and has not yet immersed in the mikvah. And that really, that issue of a woman who is anida becomes the basis of both parts of the discussion that we're hoping to have today. It's the root of why couples who are single and dating or engaged are not yet able to engage in a physical relationship. And it also stands behind what's known as the topic of harchakot that applies to married couples. And it comes from the pasuk that serves as the koteret, as the heading for all the arayot, which is ish ish al kol she'er b'saro lo tikravu the galut erva. It tells us that when we have a relationship that is forbidden, you shouldn't approach lo tikravu the galut erva. You shouldn't approach that person to reveal their nakedness. But we could take note that there's an extra word here in the pasuk, because usually it could have just as easily said lo tigalu erva, don't reveal their nakedness, and instead it says lo tikravu, don't approach them to reveal their nakedness. The Sifra, who's the Medrash Halacha on Sefer Vayikra, notes that this is the source of the fact that we have a prohibition not only on actual intercourse, which is what the Torah calls giloy erva, revealing nakedness, but also on kreval arayot, which is approaching, that doing things that could cause you to approach or come near to the things that could lead you down the path to this prohibition. And the Rambam takes off from this midrash halacha and says, from here we learn that kol haba al erva min harayot derech ivarim o shechibek v'nishek derech tava v'nehene b'kir basar hareza lokem min haTorah, that we actually have an additional biblical prohibition on physical contact with one of the arayot that comes from, when it comes from a place of desire, what we call derech tava, and when it's being done in order to take pleasure in the closeness of the flesh, that also is forbidden by the Torah. And most poskim follow in the Rambam's footsteps, even though it is important to note that others, like the Ramban, don't agree that there's a Torah prohibition when it comes to any kind of physical interaction that is short of actual intercourse. He thinks that it's either drabanan, it's rabbinic, or it's what we call chetzi shi'or. It's doing something that is not the full measurement of a biblical prohibition. Like, let's say it's forbidden for us to eat something not kosher, but really the measurement is a kezayit. So if you eat less than that, you're doing something that is prohibited on a Torah level, but you're not doing it the full way. So the same thing the Ramban says, there's no biblical prohibition on any kind of physical interaction that is not actual intercourse, but it's either rabbinic or it's doing the same prohibition, but not to the full extent. And therefore, this becomes a source, because today we know that single women, from the time that they get their period until they go to the mikvah for the first time, which is usually before their wedding, they are in a state of nida, which means that not only is there an issur of actual relations and actual intercourse, but according to the Rambam and most other poskim, there's also a prohibition that exists here on any kind of physical interaction that's coming from a place of desire. And that means that when a couple is dating and they're interacting, or even if you're in a mixed society where there is physical touch, being attentive to these laws and being what we call today shomer negiyah is a serious consideration for people in today's society.
So I'll add in one piece as I'm sort of going into my sexual educator hat for a moment, that the Rambam and those who agree with him slightly serve something that I hope many of us are speaking about, which is that the idea that the real deal is only the intercourse, according to those like the Ramban, to me is a concept, it's an idea that goes far beyond the Ramban. It's very pervasive in the world that, like, there's the real thing and then there's the other stuff. There's the other stuff that comes before, the other stuff that comes after. We're taking this broadly. We're also going to be talking about people who are just dating and it could just be holding hands. But mm-hmm. I'm just saying, even in a full sexual relationship, there's something about the Rambam that I think serves this. I think a bit of a healthier idea, which is yes, that a sexual relationship is the whole bit. Meaning, I like how you use the word intercourse as opposed to, let's say, Sex, right, which is the much broader term to describe a whole host of pleasure-creating experiences between a couple. So I'm saying I like the Rambam. Well, it's very difficult.
Because he's broadening.
He's very difficult for the singles that are dealing with this, and this is a tremendously difficult issue that we'll talk about for a married couple who does have the schut of having permissible times that they're, you know, of their month or of every month or for many more than 1 month. I like this idea better, that we're not differentiating between the act of intercourse versus all the other elements of the sexual relationship. So that's just throwing
yes.
in that piece.
And I do also just want to add that today, when people throw around the term shmirat negiyah, they're generally using it to refer to everything, you know, meaning they're lumping together both, you know, heavy physical contact, like what we would call a hookup connection or something that is more serious kind of physical interaction, in the same breath that they're talking about casually touching somebody or giving someone a handshake. And it's all kind of lumped together in this broad term, shmirat negiyah, when really the halakha knows very well how to differentiate between different kinds of touch. And sometimes we do a disservice by talking about it all together, because there are actual touches that are permitted. You know, going to a doctor, even of the opposite gender, will be permitted. Standing on a crowded bus, even if you are, you know, very much rubbed up against somebody because it's just crowded, like that would be permitted. And we shouldn't think about all kinds of touch in the same category. The Torah definitely doesn't, even though people like to talk about it all as shmirat negiyah. That's why, to me, it's also noteworthy that the Rambam makes an effort to say that we're talking about an interaction that's derech ta'ava v'nena b'kira basar.
Yes.
Even when we talk about something here that some people think is also do'oraita, biblically prohibited, they're talking about a very specific type of physical connection.
So Shana, one piece that I think is really important to bring up, and I know that when we teach our, you know, 18 to 21 year old students, it's something that's always important, is that there's like some concept that there's like, you know, a whole long list of literature that deals with the topic of shmirat negiyah, which there isn't, of course, meaning for a number of reasons. One is that, first of all, the world we're living in today of a dating world creates a very different dynamic than anything that halachic literature, even up to, you know, 100 years ago, was dealing with. We are having westernized relationships in a Torah halachic context. Shmirat negiyah, there's this assumption that this is a short, you know, relationship that's going towards marriage, and the idea that, you know, halacha is coming to sort of make people suffer while they date each other for 8 months, is, while the reality of it might be true, it's a very different way that halacha is playing out than any way that we see it expressed in the halachic literature.
Absolutely. And that's why I think that, especially because our reality has changed, it's not that sometimes people like to say, oh, you know, those rabbis, and they didn't know what they were talking about, or the halakha that they made then doesn't apply to our situation today. And I wouldn't say that it doesn't apply. What I would say is that because dynamics have changed, we have, you know, more of an urgent feeling that we need to figure out how to relate to these halachot in a way that feels healthy for us and feels appropriate and feels grounded in our reality. And that transition of, like, how do we take something that we, you know was just spoken about under different circumstances, but we think very much still is important today, how do we translate the conversation into a language that people could understand and resonate with in the society that we live and function?
So I guess I'm curious, since I know that you really do this for so many people, sort of what are some of like the broader ideas, or I would even say like philosophy, surrounding the topic of shmirat negiyah, again, now specifically for single, right, for single couples or just single people, that you think about or like to share with them?
It's definitely a topic I think a lot about. You know that I teach it in Migdal Eus, and before we made Aliyah, I also taught it to seniors in American high schools. And it's something that obviously comes up all the time in conversations with couples who are dating and who are trying to navigate this area of halakha. And lately, I'll add, it's been on my mind even more than usual, as my friend and colleague, Lori Novick, who's also a Yoetzet Halakha here in Efrat, and she's the founder and director and head writer of the website Dracheha, which is a website that the two of us work on together, We've been working on an article on Shmirat Negiah for the site, and we've been brainstorming together about how to present this topic in a way that feels authentic and feels comfortable to our readers. And it's a very different experience to put something into writing than it is to teach it. Because when you put something into writing, you really have to think about how do I want this to go out to the world when I know that I'm not necessarily going to be able to have that follow-up conversation, and I won't necessarily be able to explain, oh, no, that's not exactly what I meant. So you have to make sure that you could really, really stand behind it. So in answer to your question, especially because it's been so on my mind, I guess I'll start by saying that I personally don't like to ever be in the business of trying to convince people that keeping halakha, whether it's very challenging and sensitive areas of halakha, like the ones we're discussing today, or even areas that are less loaded, like, you know, Shabbos, for example, I never like to be in the business of selling people on some concrete benefits that I think, you know, they're going to get from this, because I really just can't guarantee that for any individual or for any couple that, you know, that it will give them what it is that I say I'm promising them. And yet, these are the halachot that we're supposed to be observing. So while I don't want to sell anyone on something that I can't guarantee, I still find it very important to figure out ways to talk about these areas in a way that will give people strength to be committed to them without creating also negativity around their own natural desires and urges or around the relationships that they're in and trying to build. So the way that I personally try to do this is by encouraging people to seek meaning in ways that are helpful specifically to them. And obviously for every person and for every couple, that's going to be something different. But I'll share with you three underlying ideas that I find meaning in when it comes to approaching these halachot. The first one, I think, grows out of the fact that, as you said, we really don't see Shmirat Negiah as a term come up in the sources. And I think there's a really good reason for that, which is that when you talk about the term Shmirat Negiah in a vacuum, it sounds like our halakha believes that, like, you should be abstaining and guarding yourself from touching anybody, as if, like, that's a value of ours. But when you look at the pasuk that I quoted earlier as the source of this area, and you see that it's talking about much bigger, greater area of intimacy and sexual intimacy and positivity, I think, wonderful things and permitted things, but with the right person at the right time, then we realize that, like, oh, it's not that we're coming in a vacuum and just saying touch is bad. It's that we're saying actually touch is wonderful and great, and intimacy is a very important and meaningful area of our lives, but it has to be with the right boundaries, with the right people at the right time. So for me, a first area of meaning around these laws is connecting them to how we think about boundaries and self-discipline in general, right? And I mean, the two of us know from working with a lot of couples that healthy relationships depend on healthy boundaries in all areas, physical boundaries and sexual boundaries and emotional boundaries and, you know, what we share and what space we need so that people feel safe and they feel respected within their relationships and within their interactions. So when we're looking to set what we feel will be appropriate boundaries, it's always going to be a mix of our own personal needs and wants and limitations together with external values and standards that are important to us. So when I talk to a religious couple who cares about halakha, obviously if someone doesn't care at all about halakha, then it's a different conversation. But when we're talking about a couple that in general sees themselves as within the system, I always make the point of saying that on the one hand, first off, it's very important to recognize and be aware that it's not natural for us to want to set limits on our physical relationship when we're dating someone that we, you know, feel connected to and close to, or, you know, obviously if we're engaged. And it's okay to acknowledge that. It's okay to say, like, I always, you know, when someone says this is so hard and it's not natural, it's like, absolutely, it's so hard and it's not natural. We don't have to pretend that it's easy. And at the same time, we know that the halakha believes that in many areas, the way that we elevate ourselves and bring in a measure of holiness, which is something we also spoke about last year, is when we set boundaries and we don't just let natural desire completely overtake us, but we harness it or we direct it or we channel it in ways that are meaningful to us. So I find that it could be very helpful to be open and honest with couples and to help them figure out how to talk it through with each other. The fact that sexual tension is real and we feel that pull to each other and it's built in, it's an inherent part of the relationship. Like, I wouldn't want to hear from a couple that this is a non-issue for us. Like, you want to know that this is something that they're feeling and that they're experiencing and that's a challenge, and because that's the way that it's supposed to be. But I also want them to realize that it's not that, okay, if we just give in to that feeling and that tension, that's going to quiet it for us, and then everything's going to be, you know, easy and not a big deal. Often the opposite is true, meaning we're humans and there's physiological processes that are happening and unfolding, and sometimes once you start something, it's not that it's impossible to stop that, but it's definitely a lot harder. And I think that a lot of couples find, you know, like, let's say they're in a Shomer Negir relationship and it's hard, and they think like, okay, if we just didn't have this boundary, then this would be a non-issue. And oftentimes when couples sometimes, you know, are not able to necessarily be 100% committed, or they are figuring out what their lines are, they realize that we still have to figure out what our lines are. Now we just have to figure out our own lines, or what are our own boundaries, or is this going to, you know, how often is this going to be? Every time that we're together, are we going to, you know, engage in this kind of physical contact? And therefore, just helping them understand that boundaries and understanding what we want as our boundaries is not only about halakha. What the halakha does here is help give us something very firm that helps maybe shape for us and find ourselves within that, you know. And I'll just conclude this, I guess, first idea with something that Dr. Yocheved Debo, she's a neighbor and a friend of mine, she's done a lot of research on this area, and she wrote her doctorate on these topics about intimacy and sexuality in our observant community. And she says that in her research, most of the participants who were in a relationship agreed that whenever they set their own boundaries, they soon found that they were unable to keep to their own commitments and moved on to more intense physical intimacy. And the conclusion that she came to was that having established guidelines from an external source, one that carries with it a certain sense of duty and commitment, such as halakha, is most likely to succeed. So for me, again, this isn't like, you know, wow, it's amazing to keep Shomer Negiyah because this is the benefit that you'll reap. But I do find that couples often could very much connect to and relate to the idea of navigating boundaries, figuring out boundaries, seeing halakha as a vehicle and a tool to help you figure out your boundaries and to help you stay true to them. And that's something that I find is one source of meaning for me when it comes to this area.
Wow. First of all, I hope that wisdom will find itself falling upon the right ears. I'm sure a lot of people can benefit from hearing that. I think that when I think about religious life in general, there are those of us who, whether we were born like this or we sort of leaned into a world of boundaries and it does us well because it's good for us to be in a framework. As I'm listening to you, I imagine somebody who's like, I don't mean that they're not boundary, that they're not healthy people, but people who like really resist feeling limited, it would be very hard for them to think yes. about that. And that doesn't negate anything you said, but I'm just thinking how there's a certain personality type that would hear that and be like, I don't want it. And I totally agree with you from the lived experience I've had with all the couples I've met, that once you start depending on your own personal boundaries you're going to create for themselves, they fly out the window very, very quickly. It's not usually...
There's just no escape from this discussion. That was my point.
Totally. Know? No, I'm saying, but it's they still have to have a discussion, but I find that they get to a point of it's all on the table pretty much pretty quickly because, as we know, right, this is a thankfully a very strong part of our humanity. So that's something I very much feel is true. I think also what I like about your language is that it kind of moves really far away from a success, failure, guilt kind of language, which is not helpful. And even couples who I've met many who, you know, I've taught and they're not necessarily upholding halachic standards, but making sure that they're not carrying with them negative feelings going into their marriage is something that's important for me also to take a look at with them, mm-hmm. because those are not helpful. We know from all the research, right? Feeling ashamed or I'm mixing in guilt and shame here, but feeling dissatisfied with behavior around this topic is not something that particularly helps people in the long run. And the other piece that I just wanted to add is that while keeping Shmirat Negiah as a non-married couple is a whole different ballgame than keeping her chakot in a married relationship, which we'll get to a little bit later, I do think that there is an interesting correlation between them, that if I did any research on it, it would be more interesting. But I think that many couples end up wanting to be very makpid in their married relationship, even if when they were dating, they weren't makpid. We see that yes. that lack of correlation very, very often in our work. In the same regard, I think practicing with boundaries before you get married is also, as you said, not guaranteeing an outcome, but we will have to negotiate boundaries in our married life as well, whether somebody is keeping Hilchot Nida every month or however often it's coming up for them, or just in general in our relationship with our spouses. Like, it's not a topic that's going to disappear once you get married.
Exactly.
I'll just say a last piece, which is that I think for those who want to feel freedom in a system with boundaries, I think part of the art form is how to keep these halachot without it feeling like they are a chain around mm-hmm. you. And I think that there are ways to go about that and ways to think about it, and you're starting to explore them. But I also think as a married couple, it's something that couples, you know, sort of experiment with over time, like how to frame the way these halachot function in your life so that it's obviously a central feature of what governs your sexual intimacy, but it doesn't have to be a constant feeling of being in no yes, which also we know from our experiences at work that that's not necessarily a healthy frame either.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree completely with everything that you're saying. And I think, you know, I guess the way that I was thinking about that first idea is sometimes just understanding of that the need for boundaries won't disappear just because you decide that these halachot are not something that you want to bring into your relationship. You're just going to need to find your own boundaries. It's not, we can't escape from this, as you said. It's not something that we're not going to have to contend with in whatever way that we do. And that helps people, I think, realize, okay, so if that's true and halacha is important to me, so then maybe I could rethink my perspective on how I thought about the idea that there's a boundary to begin with at all. Something else that I think is underlying these halachot that could be important and helpful to focus in on is just the halacha's awareness of different interactions and dynamics being right and appropriate for different times. And I think that, especially in the world that we live in today, that ability to treasure and value each stage for what it is, I find that we're always, always, always like rushing to get to the next stage. This is true in all areas of life. You know, you could choose any area, like a professional, let's say, career path. But let's talk about in terms of relationships. People start dating and then they just want to be in a serious relationship. And then they're in a serious relationship and they just want to be engaged. And then they're engaged and they just want to be married. And then you're married and you're like, ah, okay, like, what now? You know, do we want to have kids? And there's something about the halacha here that I think is asking us to slow down and say, listen, every stage has its challenge, that's for sure. But every change also has its beautiful part. Every stage also has something that you could really kind of treasure and enjoy and try to appreciate. Now, in the dating stage, the cheshek, the desire, the buildup, the sexual attention, the excitement, the anticipation is actually something that sometimes when couples are married, they find themselves thinking back to a lot. You know, remember when every little gesture, every little like slight brush, you know, by accent against each other is meaningful. I remember someone telling me that she and her husband dated in high school and then they were married for a few years and they went back home to their parents' house where they grew up and they were using the car that he had driven in high school, and they got into the car and they were like, whoa, you know, like this charge from their high school relationship that it was like, wow. And it's a reminder that like, right, why are you just waiting to get, like, you're going to get to the next stage, God willing, and you will enjoy it. But there's something also about just being able to be present and be aware in even just the buildup of the very relationship that you are involved in right now and the desire that you're feeling when it can't be expressed as in the way that you want to fully, that I think is worth treasuring and valuing. So I think this, the whole concept of Shmirat Negiah forces us a little bit to like take a pause and to like, you know, just stop for a minute and reflect on that. That doesn't mean that it has to be enjoyable at every minute. It doesn't mean that you have to relate to it and connect to it. But I think it is an aspect of something that could give meaning. And one last thing that I'll share, and maybe I feel most strongly about this, is for me, the very idea of a joint commitment, the very idea that you and I are committed to something together that's bigger than ourselves, I find that that is very, very, very powerful for couples. There's very few things in life, especially in halakha, that we're committed to together with someone else. I always say, you know, like if my husband and I have, I don't know, different levels of how makbid and stringent we are in Shabbat or in Kashrut or in Hilchot Brachot or whatever, so that's fine, that's normal. Like every couple is not exactly on the same page in terms of everything, and we could joke about it or we could roll our eyes about it or get annoyed about it, but it is what it is. But here, when two people, in this case, a couple that's dating or engaged, they decide together to bring God into their lives, even into the most intimate spaces, not because anyone else will ever really know. They could present as the most, you know, like a religious, scrupulous couple, and no one will know what they're doing behind closed doors. But the fact that they know that the two of us together are deciding to bring God into our lives because we don't think that life is only about us and our desires and what we're feeling in the moment, but we actually believe that there is an element of life that's beyond us. There's something very powerful in terms of the bond that that creates between two people when they are able to stay on the same side of that. You know, when it becomes a wedge issue, well, you don't know how hard this is for me that you don't want to give me a hug, or you don't know how hard it is for me that you want to, you know, I don't know, engage in a physical relationship when I want to be more committed, then obviously it could be very divisive. But when they're able to stay in the place of like, you know what, this is hard sometimes, but it's hard for us together. But we're choosing together to bring this into our lives because we believe in it. No one's forcing it on us. A little bit, I'll just end with this, it's a little bit sometimes the way I think of the army. You know, I've taught many young women who they themselves are in the army or they're dating guys in the army. And I always think of like, wow, it's so difficult. Like he only comes home every other Shabbat. And, you know, and if anyone would say, well, that's amazing, it must add a lot of like desire and lust. It's like, that's not what it is at all. But I will tell you what it is, what I do see going on is a lot of times because the two of them are committed to Tzahal, to Medinat Yisrael, to Am Yisrael, to protecting the Jewish people. As long as it's not, how could you do this and, you know, not come home this, as long as it's like, wow, this is hard, but we're in it together, I do see that it creates a very, very, very strong connection to be together with someone in a mission that is bigger than each of you alone and the two of you together, I think is something very meaningful.
Wow, that last one actually throws me into a few different directions. First, I want to say that these three ideas that you've shared, I think are really powerful because it takes it away, which again, commitment to halacha is important, but we both know that in the world we're living in today, just saying keep it because it's halacha, so it works for some people and it really, really doesn't necessarily keep others anchored in this. So I think that these are really great ideas because they present additional concepts, ideas, philosophies that can maybe help other people with different personalities, with different sort of like entry level, you know, where they're holding in their halachic world. I think that it provides them with multiple, like, additional avenues to get into this, which I think is really powerful. I just want to say one other thing about the last piece. I know that for me, and this is just a personal share, I know that for me, anything that I could do together with my husband makes the whole thing better. Not only because he's calm and very capable, and I'm less calm than he is, but also because I don't like doing things alone. Maybe it's like my third child thing. I don't know what it is. Meaning I don't like doing things alone. And I love that idea because I know that in my life, nothing to do with topics that we're talking about now, that has been a key for me doing things without feeling resentful or angry, right? Whether it's Shabbat preparations or it's dealing with all the kids' extracurricular activities, like we're we're both on the WhatsApps. Like, I cannot do this by myself, you know, like there's the, and feeling that we're, meaning I can, I'm pointing to it from a like, oh, a fault in myself as if there's an expectation.
No, we're in this together.
We're in this together. And I think that that in theory sits at the root of creating a family, meaning that sits at the root of it is that we're doing this together. One person is charged with the pure, you know, physical aspect of it, certainly in the beginning, but you know, once the baby is out into the world and largely weaned, like this is a joint proposition. And to me, that's also sort of the psorah. It's like the I think to me, part of the tikkun that's happening in the world today where fathers are, you know, much, much more involved than they were then. Like in theory, this idea you're saying, which sits at like, you know, an issue that couples are going to deal with in an earlier stage of their life. Again, whether or not you're like a Yosefa who you like doing things together or you're some other variation of humanity, I think that it's a really powerful idea because like it sort of sets you up in general for looking at your life together as a partnership. And we know that, I would even just say in a sexual realm, the more things are shared between couples, we know that it actually has a very direct impact on a couple's sort of like fruitful sexual relationship, meaning shared home life, shared vision is part of creating a very close bond together. And it kind of creates a certain sort of nutrition or a fountain that can also lead into all different places as well. So I just think it's a great idea because it sits at the base of something that will serve couples like in a much broader sense.
And I'll tell you also something that, you know, I was thinking about as you spoke is that a lot of times when I speak to a couple that is struggling, put guilt and shame aside, a lot of times they're sad because they feel like, why aren't we succeeding in something together that's important to us? Mm. Again, if a halacha is not important to us, we're not, you know, it's a different story. Yeah. But when they say that Avodah Hashem is important to us, they want to be able to succeed together. And in the end, they don't feel often that, they feel like they're losing a part of themselves, an integrity to themselves, and therefore helping them be able to verbalize that and get on track, not because this is the right thing to do, but because look, guys, as great as physical intimacy is, you're not happy right now. You know, that is part of this. Like, we want to feel like we could do this together.
So Shayna, I kind of want to transition our last sort of section of the episode today into married couples. I'll just sort of the word harchakot, which of course means to create some sort of, I would say, open space, separate space between a couple. As we said, from a Torah halachic idea is based in what we said earlier of lo tikruvu.
Nice that you called it open space because really harchaka like means distant. Well, I'm saying that only because I know one chatan teacher that has taught a few of the chatanim of the kalot that I taught. His name's Rav Ezra Shapiro. He's in Nofayalon in Shalvim. He's very mapid to call them shimurim, like things that we're keeping, but he doesn't like the word harchakot because it could lead a couple to think that it's supposed to create some kind of emotional distance.
Exactly.
So I liked how you said space.
And, exactly. You know, so you're right. That was very intentional what I said. So thanks for picking up on that. So, you know, this is a system. It's a catch-all phrase for a whole list of halachot. It's a whole list of halachot that don't all source from the same time period. We have a whole bunch that source from the Talmudic period, perhaps some of them also from the Mishnaic period. And then we have a whole host that are either created slash elaborated on throughout the Rishonim and afterwards. Now, when it comes to basic halachic orthodox lives, most couples are not differentiating between these, or if they would learn them inside, they're not necessarily differentiating between these, but it's sort of a catch-all phrase. So some of the list of archakot, again, I'm not going to go into the details of, you know, what we have in which sources for the sake of this conversation, but including them is not physically coming in contact with your spouse, the whole period of being in nidah.
Right. Even touch that isn't sexual or from a place of desire.
Exactly. Even touch, that's not from a place of desire. We have not sleeping in the same bed with one another. There's a much longer list. Yes, I like usually to speak about them as referring to sleeping, eating, and sitting. That's kind of like how I organize them in my brain. Halachot that relate to how we sleep in the same room, that even though we are, and I'll bring in one piece, that relate to sleeping, eating, and sitting. How we serve, do we not serve directly? That in there, here there's a slight non-parallel track between what men and women can do for each other. Again, mamash like a general concept here that we can be served food or by our spouses, and there's different, slightly different halachic nuances here, but that we're not supposed to serve directly. A woman shouldn't serve directly to her husband. So there's different halachot that are relegated to how they're eating together, how they're sharing a table, assuming that they're the only ones at that table. Once they're not the only ones at that table, a lot of these halachot also will not apply in that same way. As we said, to do with sleeping in the same bed or even sitting on each other's bed. There's also halachot that are relegated to that realm. Sitting together in shared spaces, whether it's on the same couch or in the halachic literature, they like to talk about some sort of wagon in certain cases. But the point is what you're sitting with each other on one space where you could feel the weight of the other person. And another, also famously, passing from hand to hand, which is another of the harchakot that comes up and that is very prominent for couples in figuring out how to navigate, like how they do life together when they're not necessarily passing from hand to hand. And there are others, but those are sort of, I think, some of the main harchakot that come into play. So whenever I teach couples, so I say that, look, among all the different elements of Hilchot Nida, this is generally very hard. This is of the harder ones. It creates, as you said, it has the potential to create not only physical distance, but emotional distance. And so I spend quite a bit of time trying to speak with them about how we can avoid falling into some of those spaces. On one hand, our physical relationship is a central, critical, important, and should be, hopefully, a wonderful part of our relationship. And we are eliminating a very basic way of communicating. Humans need touch, even if it isn't your dominant way of expressing love. It is something that definitely one feels is lacking. I think that is just a feature of these halachot, and different people experience them in different ways. On the other hand, one piece that I do like to think about is the fact that I like the fact that the harchakot are not only related to what happens in a couple's bedroom, meaning on one hand it's limiting, and that could be frustrating or difficult, and something that a couple simply needs to learn how to communicate around. Meaning there's an element here of trial and error, of figuring out how to go about it, how to live with these halachot, and figuring out how we can both continue to communicate, show love, and be loving with each other while having some of our basic tools sort of taken out of our toolbox for a certain amount of time. On the other hand, I think that it also just, and this isn't something that I think is particularly comforting in every moment, but I think that as a broader philosophical idea, I like the fact that we're being reminded that we express our love for each other and our intimate relationship in all different ways, in all different spaces. And yes, there is something that is intimate about, again, not necessarily sexually intimate, but there's something intimate about me handing my spouse a coffee that I made for him, right? Or you know, handing something hand to hand. When a couple was dating and they sort of, as you said before, they like brushed hands or they sat next to each other on their bus, or there, these little gestures are significant. And on one hand, it could be hard to emerge from that sensitive space when you go back into the permissible section. On the other hand, I do like that it creates a little bit of a sensitivity surrounding that, reminding us that those gestures are things that bring closeness. And so it's not just about, you know, is a couple having an active sexual relationship right now, but it's all of the loving, intimate, and yes, sometimes sexual elements that sort of surround it, that I think is something that, to me, I find meaningful. Doesn't mean that it makes one like keeping hilchot, keeping the harchakot. That's not at all what I'm trying to say. But on a philosophical idea, I want couples to think about their intimate relationship as going far beyond what happened in their bedroom, because to have a loving, again, I'm totally blurring the lines here between sexual and non-sexual, and I'm doing that purposefully because I think that that's part of what creates a healthy sexual relationship, is that that being very harshly boundary between what happens there, what happens outside, can sometimes make those kind of transitions very difficult. So if we're remembering that we love each other and we're giving each other a hug in the kitchen and touching each other there in a loving, maybe more or less sexual way, okay, but it also makes this concept of being physically intimate with our spouses in a place that's quote unquote defined as sexual to be a much less of a big leap. And so it's sort of like blurred. I like that the spaces should be blurred in general, and the harchakot remind us that it really does touch all these different elements.
So interesting, because I very much relate to the idea that intimacy is not only in the bedroom, and that obviously for a couple to create a strong connection, it's about being attentive to each other's needs in all different realms. And you know, when he asks you to pass you the keys and you don't just put them on the table, but you actually walk over to give them to him, there is something meaningful about that. Mm-hmm. Or preparing a cup of coffee in the morning and, you know, and putting in that effort. But I personally, when I try to put the harchakot into a framework, it's not that I like stay away from that because I don't think what you're saying has truth to it. It's just honestly not how I understand, I guess I'll say, or even personally experience the harchakot. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, I see, you know, beyond that prohibition of, as we said, actual intercourse. So we said there's the issue of all other like real physical contact. And that obviously is about something sexual and about intimacy or whatever. And then there's all these other harchakot, which I agree, they connect to intimacy, but the way that I understand them, and it's just not my own idea, it's really based on something that I grew up, he was called the Rosh in America, and now he's called the Rosh in Israel. So I go back and forth between how I refer to him, but we're sitting here in Efrat, so I'll call him the Rosh. So something that the Rosh says is that when he's describing harchakot that a married couple has to keep, he says that usually when there's a prohibition of intercourse on the table, the Torah has this great thing called an isur yichud, which is that, oh, if you don't completely seclude yourselves, that is a really great safeguard and a really good, a really good tool to help you be able to remain committed to this. But obviously, when a couple is married, that prohibition of not being secluded together doesn't apply. So in his words, he says, so bishvil shemityachei tzadirima, because now they are going to be alone together all the time. And here you have this cute little newly married couple in their new, you know, beautiful apartment in their bedroom, but they're just as prohibited to each other in terms of that sexual relationship right now as they were when they were dating. So he says, because yichud is permitted, asu geder v'siyag sheyizkor et nidoteha. They put in all kinds of like boundaries and fences. For me, the key word is sheyizkor et nidoteha, in order to remind them, oh yeah, we love each other and we're really attracted to each other and we have a great time together, but right now there's certain aspects of our relationship or interaction that are off limits right now. And therefore I see the harchakot almost as like a system of reminders that are sprinkled throughout the day into different areas. So when I teach it, I break it up into areas that are connected to touch, areas that are connected to eating, like you said, areas that are connected to the bedroom, and then general behavior. And it's like, oh, in every area, there's a few little reminders. And the way that I think of it is like, on Shabbos in a house, a lot of people put a magnet over their light switch. Now, if you don't care about Shabbos, you'll just come and brush that magnet aside and turn on the light. But if you do care about Shabbos, it's very normal to walk into the bathroom and just like flip the switch, because that's the routine that we're used to being in. So the magnet is there as like a little reminder, all right, Shabbos, you know, and it doesn't stop someone from doing something who doesn't care, but it will very much help remind someone who is in the mindset of wanting to be committed to remember that this is something that applies right now. So I see a lot of the harchakot as that, you know, I see it as like, oh, don't pass right now, not necessarily because passing is something that is part of creating intimacy, which it is, but I see it more as don't pass right now because, you know, when you put that pen on the table, it's like, all right, we're in Nida, because it's so easy to forget that because we have our normal natural relationship, which is like very intimate and close, and like we'll casually touch each other all the time. So it's these little reminders that remind us like, oh yeah. The reason that I personally don't like to, when I'm educating about this, go in the direction of like, you know, playing up the opportunities for closeness or intimacy, even though I really do believe that they are, you know, in marriage opportunities for closeness, is because I find that not everyone relates to this. Definitely not everyone relates to it all the time. I personally don't always relate to all these things all the time as being opportunities for closeness. And then if someone doesn't relate to it, I think either they could feel like, well, this is such a stupid halakha because I don't connect to it, so I guess it's not relevant for us. Why should we have to keep it if we don't feel like this is something that connects to our closeness or our intimacy? Or on the flip side, if they feel like, well, this is the halakha, and obviously this is what's supposed to be right, then they could end up feeling like something's wrong with us, that clearly we don't connect to this. Why don't we feel like we find closeness or intimacy in these little things? So that's one reason that I, just usually stay away from that direction. And the other one is, because as much as maybe within a marriage, it's true that maybe walking over to pass something to him is a point where I could show that I care and whatever, I feel like passing, as an example, is something that's just part of our normal interaction with so many people all the time. And I don't want to live in a, I guess, realm where I get in the habit of thinking that passing, as an example, is something that creates some kind of bond or intimate connection, because, you know, I'm passing to male colleagues at work all the time, or to the guy at the cashier or whatever it is. I think of it more as just something that I don't do with my husband right now, as a reminder that we're, you know, in need right now, but not as something that necessarily has deeper inherent value, you know. So then sometimes people ask, so then, like, well, then how did they choose these things specifically as reminders if you don't think they have deeper inherent value? And they're obviously, of course, I will admit that, like, not sleeping in the same bed is clearly like a classic siyag, like don't sleep in the same bed because that could lead you. But for some of the smaller little nitty gritty things, I look at it as I look at a lot of the details of halakha, where I find meaning in the system and in the big picture, but not necessarily in all of the tiny little things that make the system work. That's how systems work. Mm-hmm. Systems need to be actualized in concrete details, but not necessarily because there's always inherent meaning each one of them. So, you know, again, it's not that these two approaches can't work together, but I think they do go a little bit in different directions.
So I really wanted to respond to that. First of all, I teach both. The first thing I say is they come essentially in place of yichud. That shows up in a lot of the halachic literature. And I think that it's really helpful from, like, just like a cognitive frame, mm-hmm. of like how to get what this is doing here. I think that it's
It also answers why dating an engaged couples don't have to keep
this. Exactly, laws. Exactly. And I say, well, you're still living in the same room, but you don't, right? So we got to do something. Exactly. So that's the first thing I say. That's like my base level. I just want to respond to what you said with, because you like the reminder piece. And again, when I present it as it's just an idea, it's not a justification, right? All the prerequisites of, like, I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything here. But I want to say, on a personal level, keeping these halachot every month, I don't really need a reminder. Like, I know, meaning when it's happening on a regular basis, I don't actually want to be reminded in the kitchen that, like, this is again. Like, oh, we were just here 2.5 weeks ago. Do you know what I'm saying? So, like, I don't actually like feeling reminded because I can find it, like, annoying. So I like the softness that's created of, like, this is a potentially intimate context, and this is the time of the month that we're neutralizing that intimate context. I also mentioned, like, I mentioned it earlier in the episode of, like, this feeling of, like, sometimes throughout a married life, there's just a need, and as a human life, a need to, like, reframe things. It is, to me, it's part of reframing, like, the yes, no, or, like, how to reframe so that there's something a bit softer about it. Mm-hmm. Something for me about a reminder simply feels annoying to me. It's not unpleasant. It's just annoying. Just like how my kids think I'm annoying when I remind them to, I don't know, take their guitar. Oops, I didn't tell her this morning. I hope she remembered. But, like, meaning, you know, reminders can be, like, annoying. So
yeah, I hear that.
I don't want halakha to feel that way. And it does, by the way, even if I don't call it a reminder. So I just kind of like that because it feels a little bit softer.
At the
to
end,
me.
It's the same laws for everyone. But I think part of what's coming out of this is that the framing is so important, and to find the framing that speaks to you and that helps you really goes a long way in making, more palatable in terms of being able to approach these laws. If I could add in one other thing, just because it comes up so much about harchakot, you hear people say sometimes, like, well, harchakot are really, really great because not only do they, you know, build in that kind of space that leads you to be able to crave and to miss and to long and to want and whatever, and there's definitely truth to that, you know, but we spoke about that a little bit last year. I think the other thing that sometimes people say is that harchakot are great because when other things are off limits, then, like, you have to talk more and you have to communicate more. And it's hard for me when people say that because, first of all, don't try to tell me that something's great when it doesn't always feel to me great. You know, it's like in Corona when people would say, wow, isn't it wonderful that, like, you know, all of a sudden we could have smaller weddings? It's like, no, this isn't wonderful at all. If you want to tell me that once it's here and we're dealing with it, let's try to find whatever meaning we can, that's very different than trying to sell someone on that it's wonderful. But I think what's hard for me also when people say that is that communication is something that should be happening always. And it should be something that is the foundation of a relationship, whatever, you know, the time of the month is. But if I will try to tap into what it is when people are saying there, and this thing, I think it is worth it to mention, and I do try to reach with couples when I'm teaching them, is that it is very, very normal that when we have touch as part of our life, sometimes, and in a very good way, touch will, you know, take the place of a much larger conversation that maybe needed to happen. So, you know, I like to give the example of, like, if I don't know, you know, I stopped at my husband because he didn't take out the garbage, and then he's like, "Whoa, Shayna," and I'm like, "Okay, no, you're right." You know, like, I'm just like, I'm under pressure and I'm running late and whatever, whatever. So if you give each other a big hug, so it kind of like smooths it over. It's like that Band-Aid, you know, and like you go off to work, and then by the time you come back hours later, who even remembers that that happened until it happens again the next day? Because really, when the garbage is overflowing, you know, it's, for me, it's not just like, oh, the garbage is overflowing. It's like, well, in my house, my father always took out the garbage. You know, that's what it means to be the man of the house, and you're failing in that. But I'm not even aware of that, because like we gave the hug and whatever, and everything's fine now. And sometimes I do find that when you don't have that hug, which is wonderful, I would never want to take it away from people. But sometimes when you don't, and you say to a couple, listen, when you're Anita, it's like it needs to be like first and foremost on your mind that we didn't choose this time and we don't necessarily want this time, but if it's here, we need to find a way to make it as good and close as possible. So then when you come back from work and you're like, oh, it's still sitting on me, that interaction in the morning that wasn't so pleasant, sometimes you're like, let's go sit on the couch. What is going on with the garbage? Why is it such a trigger point? And that's when a lot of times you're able to get sometimes to that deeper place that should always be happening, even when you have the hug. But just, you know, life and kids and work and things are busy, and we don't always take the time. So I don't feel like Nida is there for that. But once we have Nida, I think it is extra important that couples take the time to go deeper in those moments and not let distance build between them, because it could be that, you know, here you're backing up into your corner and he's in his corner, and then, you know, all of a sudden Shevnike and pass, and who wants to go to the mikvah and, like, you know, be with him when he doesn't even take out the garbage? But if you manage to have a deeper conversation and you're like, wow, this was so insightful, and all of a sudden I understand myself and I understand him, and, you know, this is where we're coming from, then it's like, wow, I feel so much closer to you. I feel like we understand each other so much better. I feel like we just did real work. We dug deeper, and like we got somewhere that was actually really significant and illuminating and eye-opening. I can't wait to like go to the mikvah and be able to express that now in a physical way. So again, it's that fine line between not saying this is why we have Nida, and yet saying once Nida's here, let's try to, I don't know, make sure we're doing a good job at it.
There's a lot of wisdom there, and we're gonna be wrapping up. I guess the only thing I want to add, because I totally agree with that. In general, I think that, you know, there are some people who their relationship or one spouse of the relationship really, really has a tough time with verbal communication, and that will present particularly challenges for those couples. Like there is a marked difference between how different couples deal with these halachot in their lives, yes. And it's based on their skill set, on just the way they experience the world. There are some people that are really, 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 really tactile, visceral people, and they're going to experience these halachot somewhat differently based on how that element of their life interacts with sexuality, which could also be surprising. Mm-hmm. I also find that like it's largely good to just have a curious attitude, and it takes a lot of time. And you know, when I check in with my couples, I meet every kala I meet after she gets married, and there's no comparing the initial experiences of keeping l'chonita with how it's going to be a long time later. And please God, we're in it for the long haul. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and we're all gonna, you know, have our moments. We're gonna have challenges. These are not easy. I think that many people experience a real test of their halachic loyalty surrounding these halachot more than we experience in other realms of our life. But I think that if we take it sort of as a life project, and not every month, just like with a Shomer Negiah, our halachic commitment, worthiness, and sense of self don't have to be on the line when it comes to keeping these. They're super deep. They hit at the most intimate parts of our of our personal lives and of our shared life together. But I think that if we sort of take it as something that we're curious about, let's like once in a while observe how we're behaving with this, and then we're able to tweak it over time and see how can this function better? How can we function better with these things? I think all of what we're saying is sort of like this big call, not necessarily to find meaning, but to try and do it, if we're committed to it, to do it as best as possible so that we could flourish as a couple. I feel like that's maybe like the line I really want us to take with us, is we want to flourish with this. We don't want to feel like it's squelching who we are, like it's deeply, and I'm sure there are many people listening who've been married a long time and who were taught a long time ago, Shayna, and I'm sure that they didn't hear anything like this. And so I just want to say for a moment, we feel you, we're with you. There is, you know, part of the blessings of a much more open, developed world, both just emotionally and sexually also, like to have these conversations. We do hope that couples are being prepared a little bit better than they used to be. And I do just want to say that if you're listening and saying like, oh, wow, could have been great to hear this like 25 years ago. So I also just want to say that if it's still a part of your life, it's never too late to try and navigate these better. And like, we just want to be our best versions of ourselves now. And so I think it's just also, it could be helpful even now at this point in life.
Absolutely. I love that. And I love that in general, both with Shmirat Negiah or with our Harkot, this isn't like a all or nothing kind of thing. It's processes that unfold over time. Your experiences evolve over time. Not each time feels the same. Every day is a new day. Going back to Shmirat Negiah, even if people struggle at some point, that doesn't mean they're going to struggle always, which is why, as you said earlier, we see many couples who struggle when they're dating and engaged, and then they're able to embrace the set of halachot when they're married, and to just kind of take that deep breath and say our goal is to navigate this as best as possible.
Shayna, thank you again for coming on the podcast. It's always an honor and it's always enlightening. So thank you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode from Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please contact the Matan office or email me at podcast@matan.org.il. Please do us and all women's Torah learning a favor and share this episode with all of your friends and family.